Hello and welcome to the Big Technology Podcast, a show for cool-headed, nuanced conversation of the tech world and beyond. Our guest today is Max Chafkin. He is a features editor at Bloomberg Businessweek and the author of the brand new book, just hit shelves yesterday. It's called The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. It's interesting that you also say one Silicon Valley. So we have to get into that. Is there one? Is there many Silicon Valleys? Is Silicon Valley a location? Is it an idea? Is it uniform? Does it contain multitudes, as the LA Times just spoke about your book? Anyway, Max, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alex. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, you see, you already got me excited. I learned so much from this book, and I'm just like thrilled to be talking to you. And I think this is going to be a fun discussion. So why don't we start here? Peter Thiel is one guy. We see him in headlines every now and again. He's done, you know, a handful of things. Has he built the most impressive companies in Silicon Valley? I don't think so. Certainly a presence there. So why is he so important that you became, you know, obsessed in the way that got you to write a book? And you know, we're about to spend about an hour talking about him. Why do people, if people are going to listen to one of the episodes of this podcast, why would this be the one?
Yeah. So I've got two answers. The kind of quick answer is he's fascinating. He's somebody who's full of contradictions. You know, I think the thing that caught a lot of people's attention with Thiel as a figure of fascination, you know, in 2016, when he endorsed Donald Trump, right, there's this feeling of like this futurist, this prominent futurist who's a gay immigrant from California, is backing a reactionary anti-immigrant New York real estate developer who's running on a nativist platform. Like, that's weird and interesting. And to me, like, that is, I think, you know, as obvious as that sounds, I think that's part of the kernel of why people care about him. But I mean, the real answer to your question is, and this is something that, you know, I thought about as I was writing the book and tried to develop it, but Thiel, I think, as you say, he's not the richest tech mogul. He hasn't started the best companies. There are certainly stories you could tell about the tech industry over the last 20 years where other people would be kind of in the main character and would be like the main character. But I would argue that Thiel has had a bigger cultural impact on the tech industry than any single person. And so, like, by that I mean how the tech industry sees itself, how companies see what they do and how they do business. So in other words, this idea that founders, that the class of the founder is this kind of special person who has a privileged access to kind of like what the company is supposed to do and who's right, who's just knows what's best. That came from Peter Thiel. I mean, that comes from Founders right. Fund. And that that ethos, I think, you know, goes a long way to explaining like a lot of the weird stuff that has happened in the tech industry over the last 20 years as the tech industry kind of spills into you know, whatever the real world as Facebook.
Right, right. But Max, isn't it more than that though? It's more than just trusting the founder, right?
Like, of course.
It is, having read your book, it is in particular this libertarian impulse that he has. This
absolutely.
Anti-institutionism.
Right.
That essentially says, you know, screw the government, screw the rules. Disruption is almost de facto good.
Absolutely.
And that is something, I mean, he starts with the company PayPal, which you outlined pretty impressively, was, yes, about sending money on the internet, but also in some ways breaking the global financial system. So,
yeah,
of course, he did this thing called Founders Fund where he wants to empower the founder. And he talked about, you know, how bad education is and paid people to drop out of school. But, you know, having read your book, my takeaway was that his core cultural impact on Silicon Valley was convincing people that, you know, they should and could break down the system in any way possible. And this is, you know, obviously do it for money. But to me, it seemed, you know, from his very early years, he had this libertarian anti-institutionalist streak. And that extended, you know, to so many people he came into contact in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I wrote down a few that have worked with him. I mean, you talk about Elon Musk, David Karp, Joe Lonsdale,
Alex Karp,
David Sachs. Yeah, sorry. David Sachs, Alex Karp, Joe Lonsdale. I mean, it's unbelievable how many people have sort of come into his orbit and seem to have walked away as Thelis, you know, from their from the philosophical standpoint.
I 100% agree with everything you just said. And I think you just put your finger on exactly, I'd say, like, the most important thing about Thiel's, you know, kind of ideology and identity is this idea, yeah, that breaking the rules, it's not just that it has neutral value. It's not just that it's that the rules can be ignored. It's that there's something good about breaking the rules. And that, I think, you can sort of see why that would be useful if you're building a startup. But it's also, you know, obviously can have, you know, detrimental effects. And now we've created, this is why I think it's really important to pay attention to somebody like Peter Thiel and to pay attention to Thiel in particular, because that ethos, Thielism, if you want to call it that, is basically the main ethos of Facebook, of most of the bigger companies in Silicon Valley. This idea that the rules, yeah, just aren't that important, and maybe it's best to cast them aside from time to time.
And it seems like he hated people who were pro-government, pro-institution.
Yep.
In part because he was bullied as a kid and was sort of an outcast. And you know, he grew up in Silicon Valley, if I remember correctly, and people didn't treat him well. And he like, you are out there saying you're going to go, you know, heal the world and you know what's right and you're precious institutions and this is the way you treat someone, I'm going to wreck it. And that seemed to have defined a lot of what he did through life. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the Thiel family.
It's amazing how much comes back to bullying.
It is. Yeah, seriously. They were outsiders. You know, his parents were German immigrants, very conservative, very religious. And he moved around a lot as a kid. You know, they bounced from Cleveland, to South Africa, and then finally to Foster City, which is this suburb, in the Bay Area, but it's pretty far removed from Silicon Valley.
Built on, like, marshlands.
Yeah, it's not the nicest.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the houses there are pretty expensive, just like everywhere else, but it's kind of a world away.
Yeah, you can look at it as you're flying into SFO right out the window. Yeah. That's what you look at.
And so, yeah, he definitely was, very smart and withdrawn, and angry. And I think, you know, some of that anger, like you said, it came from bullying, and it kind of spilled into his, sort of output as a human, first in, as an undergraduate at Stanford, starting this kind of, you know, very hard right wing, newspaper, the Stanford Review, and then continuing on, you know, throughout his career.
So here's what I'm puzzled by. So someone who grows up as an outcast and has this, the world be damned attitude, and wants to wreck things, how does he end up having the influence in Silicon Valley that influenced all the people, you know, that we just spoke about? But by the way, let's add Mark Zuckerberg to the list. He funded Facebook and he's a Facebook board member.
Absolutely.
If you're encountering a group of generally optimistic builders, how does this, you know, very dark attitude towards the world and its institutions take such a hold inside that community?
So I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I talked to a lot of, former PayPal employees. And I think it's weird. PayPal has really, people know a lot about PayPal and tech. It's been kind of scrutinized a lot, I think rightly, but there's still things like that I are probably underappreciated. And I think one is the extent to which there was this kind of band of brothers at PayPal who were all from this conservative publication. Like, there were, like, it wasn't just, oh, Thiel starts a conservative newspaper and then, you know, goes to law school and then gets into tech. But, like, he really brought along this whole crew of people, and their whole thing had been kind of us against the world. And that then became transposed, you know, into PayPal, where PayPal, you know, there was a political aspect to PayPal, which is something people overlook. You kind of hinted at it, but, you know, in the early days, they were talking about it, as you said, like, as this thing that would break not just the global banking system, but like national sovereignty, that it would make it impossible for countries to regulate their monetary systems, to make it possible for people in repressive states to, you know, obviously to move money in or out easily. And so it was this, you know, overtly political thing. And then there were, you know, then it sort of transposes into, you know, it's us against the corporatists. It's us against eBay, which, you know, for a long time, eBay bought PayPal, but for a long time, eBay was there, was also their kind of main antagonist. And I think
he didn't, Thiel and Meg Whitman just weren't on speaking terms by the time that acquisition.
No, I think there's like, that is a, yeah, they are like, I don't know, opposite ends of the spectrum.
I mean, Thiel seems to have fought with everyone. I mean, he also fought with Elon and did a coup to sort of take
the, yeah, exactly,
take over him. So yeah, but sorry, go keep going.
Anyway, I was just going to say these, when you talk to these guys about kind of like what, you know, why was PayPal successful? One of the things they say is like, we had this sense that it was like us against the world. There's this kind of a cohesiveness to the PayPal team. And I think that that kind of, you know, basically spun forward into the PayPal mafia, this kind of feeling that it's us against the world. You know, I don't think people have noticed that political thing much, but like, I think a lot of the kind of some of this kind of cult of disruption stuff that we see in Silicon Valley, probably best epitomized by like Uber or something, I think kind of has its roots in right-wing activist politics, the right-wing activist politics of the 1980s, which is like where Thiel did like his first, you know, it wasn't a business really, although I guess it kind of was a business, his first entrepreneurial venture. And, you know, in right-wing activist politics, you know, there's this like big tradition of, you know, kind of like screwing with the administration. There are all these stories of sort of college newspaper editors like going in and stealing you know, lists of names from the registrar or like, you know, sort of doing these like acts of protest or whatever and sort of finding ways around the institutions. And I think that kind of spirit, you know, you can, you know, draw a line straight to some of the things that PayPal did, because PayPal totally just ignored every banking regulation. They, you know, it wasn't just that they were ideologically opposed to, you know, like the normal model of regulating currencies. They were just actively just you know, saying screw it, and eventually they you know, got away with it. I mean, I don't know if "got away with it" is the right word, but you know, they were able to navigate the company to a successful exit and settle with the regulators and kind of integrate themselves into the global financial system. And I think you know, the rest of the tech industry, you know, kind of learned a valuable lesson from that experience, which is that you can, you know, you can succeed by pursuing this sort of regulatory arbitrage, by attacking a regulated industry and by making one of your points of differentiation that you do not follow the rules.
So it's largely accepted as fact that Silicon Valley portrays itself as a save the world type of companies versus we're just doing this to make money. How do those two things look when you juxtapose them? The we're trying to take down the system and this, you know, we're here to heal the world, or some of the Zuckerberg language.
So I think they're kind of two threads of kind of ideology that, and I argue this in the book, it's definitely up for debate, but here's how, but the way I think about it, right? And this is first suggested to me by Roger McNamee, who's a, you know, venture capitalist who, you know, has turned critic of Facebook. But basically you have kind of like the Steve Jobs way of thinking about companies. And I think obviously there's some hypocrisy here, but the basic idea is that business is a form of creative expression, and it's a way to like help people get the most out of themselves. Like, you know, kind of, new age human business as like new age human potential movement stuff. So, Apple of course fits into that. But so does Google, right? You know, it's like, we're making the world's information accessible. We're making you smarter or whatever it is. And then there's this like other thread, which is the Thielist thread, which is business as disruption, business as power. And that is, you know, grow as big as you can and and like, you know, get a monopoly. I mean, in that, you know, Thiel wrote a whole book, Zero to One, where the basic takeaway is, you know, businesses, if they want to succeed, they should strive for, you know, monopoly profits, which is another way of saying, you know, dominance. And so I don't think those two things can be reconciled. I think they're like on two sides of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, obviously the Thiel view is very, very cynical. But of course, you know, a lot of these companies that say they're saving the world are actually, you know, they're just sort of saying, I don't know. I think both those frameworks are potentially useful to like understand Silicon Valley and understand why it's grown so quickly and stuff.
Yeah, I think my theory on this is that Steve Jobs warped a lot of people's view of what tech is.
Yeah.
And because he was so hard, so influential and so hard on the save the world mentality, that everyone had this picture in their head that that's what tech is. In fact, I think you mentioned the tech press's influence a bunch in the book, which I thought was great. And I think the tech press, in large part, wanted every founder to be Steve Jobs. I mean, you see what's happening with Elizabeth Holmes. It was
totally.
Her responding to those incentives, and how many covers did she get wearing the turtleneck while she was defrauding everybody. So I think that was something that folks felt they needed to portray to the outside world. But if you looked on the inside, it was right. Thiel mentality all the way.
Yeah. For sure. And it's kind of funny. I went back and read a bunch of the the output about the tech industry. You know, there were books written, in the early 2000s, and a lot of there were essays and stuff all about how the role of the counterculture in forming Silicon Valley, which I think is okay. Like, it's totally valid, and yes, Steve Jobs was a bit of a hippie, but it's kind of a weird way of looking at an industry that literally started as an extension of the U.S. military, and there's nothing. There are countercultural things about Silicon Valley, but to see the tech industry as just this kind of outgrowth of 60s counterculture is like to miss, you know, the whole beginning of the industry and like a thread that probably is just as important as, like, as you say, you know, something that kind of a little bit came down to branding or something like that,
right.
Which is like these guys talking about saving the world. But I don't know. I mean, the real root is, you know, a bunch of defense contractors.
Yeah, well, there's something to root for in the word disrupt. I do think that the tech industry's claims that the way things have been done for a long time have been corrupt and hurt people. I think there's any doubt about that. And they especially resonated in the time of the financial crisis. I think you even talk about how
absolutely.
You approached Thiel and you asked him to participate in the How I Built This article. And you were talking about how it was a little schlocky, but we were looking for ways to be like, you know, there's got to be some optimism because the old way just brought down the whole economy.
Yep.
But there is, you know, you can see some virtue in what these companies are doing, but that's where the story starts. But so many times it actually gets actualized in this Thielist way, which is like Thiel had from your book, it's clear. He had hate for institutions. And eventually that came through in his recommendations once he got asked to help staff the Trump administration, which we'll get to after the break. But it is interesting to see how, like, you know, it could start from a virtuous place, but very often end in a bad place. And it seems like, you know, I don't know, it seems like Thiel had a large hand in that.
Yeah, 100%. I also think, you know, there's something just, appealing about the honesty of the Thiel worldview, especially if you're feeling a little bit, if you're feeling betrayed, like the kind of post financial crisis mode, if you're feeling betrayed by institutions, or if you're just kind of fed up with the hypocrisy of, of that's kind of inherent to capitalism, the sort of cynical worldview of just sort of like, get as big as you can and make as much money as you can. And, you know, forget being good, like that has, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a bad person or something, but I see the appeal. I was
going to ask if some of this stuff resonated with you. I mean, some of these institutions, I mean, look, I don't know. I feel like I tend to believe in institutions sometimes more than I should, but some of them are bad.
And if
you look at the state of the country, and obviously I don't think the Thiel mentality has helped this very much, but people have been let down by their institutions and they don't believe them anymore. Right. And so the idea of burning them down is appealing in some way, even though it might not be the right solution. I really think that reforming them is the right solution, but I can see why burning them down has a real appeal among a lot of people.
I mean, Thiel would not be would not have so many followers. He would not be dangerous if he wasn't right a lot. I mean, that's the thing about – so like I think – I mean, he was obviously the – you know, for instance, his critique of universities, right? It has a lot – there's a lot of truth to it. You know, universities have been, you know, overcharging people and have been, you know, failing to prepare students. And but is the answer to convince like a bunch of 17-year-olds to like not go to college, especially like not to go to the best, like, you know, I'm not sure that the answers are correct, but often like his diagnosis of the problem is really effective and is true. I mean, he's gotten, you know, Jeff Bezos like famously ripped Thiel once by saying, you know, think about contrarians as they, you know, they get most things wrong. But Thiel's been right a lot, at least right on the kind of on the big things. Often I think the execution is where he's sort of screwed up, either financially, like not made as much money as he could have, or just done something kind of objectionable or dangerous or something like that.
Yeah, I want to get back to the biography details and then keep going on this thread. So why don't we do that right after the break? We'll be back here on Big Technology Podcast. We got Max Chafkin. He is the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. It's a great book. We'll be back right after this. And we're back here on the Big Technology Podcast with Max Chafkin. He's talking to us about his Peter Thiel book, The Contrarian. So, you know, we talked a little bit about how Peter Thiel went to PayPal and had this burn down the system type of mentality. But how does he then spread his influence? Because look, at the end of the day, there's a lot of founders and there's a lot of technologists with kooky views or extreme views or passionate views about different subjects. They don't always build a following. So was it when Thiel then, you know, moved on from PayPal and started a very successful hedge fund and then eventually a venture capital firm that some of the ideas that he had about society started to take hold?
Absolutely. And I think he did it on purpose. Like it wasn't something that just happened by accident. You know, I think Thiel, obviously he's respected as a very smart investor, as a futurist. I think he has, you know, his moments of rhetorical brilliance. But he's also like a really good marketer. And I think, Thiel as kind of an influencer or as a, you know, self-created figure, it's actually probably a helpful way to think about him. Actually, I would argue it's helpful for thinking a lot of these, sort of tech industry figures, but in any case,
as an influencer.
They're the original
influencers.
We could have a whole discussion about Elon Musk. Like, I think Elon Musk is totally underrated as a marketer, and like, just, and I'm not to say,
are you sure? I think people really understand Elon's.
Well, okay, maybe it's skills. Maybe people are coming around to him now that he can like move the stock price by up. But anyway, let me get back on track. I think Thiel, coming out of PayPal, and he made a little bit of money. And I think he very self-consciously set out to turn himself into this a figure of interest and of influence. And at first, and you can kind of see this because his early efforts of it were really bad. He opened a restaurant. It was like a kind of a restaurant nightclub called Frison.
Sounded kind of fun.
How
much money did he spend to build a thing?
I think there's some detail in the book about like the cost of the sound system, and it just sounds
$1 million, I think,
pretty tacky. And it wasn't immediately successful like as a restaurant. It went out of business. He also started a NASCAR magazine. You know, despite I don't think being, you know, a big sports guy or whatever,
with, like, opinions about like basically how. What was men were happy that women were cooking for them in a NASCAR. Anyways,
it was just like a weird combination of like sort of college political magazine, right-wing college political magazine with a sports magazine. They hired like these Weekly Standard columnists to write car columns, and they, you know, inevitably, you know, wrote kind of like Weekly Standard columns. And of course, you know, people who are race car fans, they might be conservative, but like they're not picking up a race car to get the like Peter Thiel view of gender relations or something.
That magazine, by the way, just seemed to me like something that someone would imagine in a laboratory about like what NASCAR fans would want. Without 100%. Ever having gone to a NASCAR race and never spoken to a NASCAR fan.
Or what a rich guy who was trying to establish himself as a big time investor, hedge fund guy might do. And because of course, maybe
I mean, all of the above.
Yeah. Media, of course, media is a great way to create influence and same thing, like to get invited to cool parties, and having a restaurant's a way to get invited to cool parties or have cool parties. And I think he was very explicitly trying to create this aura around him as an investor. And it was originally as like a hedge fund guy. And this is kind of one of the funny things to me, because like if you grab like a random person on the street, like a random Wall Street Journal reader in 2005, 2006, and said, "Who is Peter Thiel?" And they would say, "Oh, Peter Thiel, he's one of the most successful hedge fund managers in the world." They would never have said, "Oh, he's a technologist," anything like that. He was like the next George Soros. And he was totally styling himself as that, not as this technologist. And it's only
Let's define what that is. He was betting large amounts of money on things failing.
Yeah, broadly, yeah, it's betting on, you know, macroeconomic swings, but in the specific case for Thiel, he was betting against the U.S. economy,
and this was a guy who even left PayPal and bet against PayPal.
He wanted to. I actually don't know for sure if he did. Whether he followed through with the investments.
That
was the
message going out the door. So
yes, exactly, and he's, you know, I talked to you know, folks who worked, you know, at his investment firm in those years. And they talked about this very explicit notion that Thiel has two portfolios, an optimistic portfolio and a pessimistic portfolio. The optimistic portfolio is the startup investing. It's Facebook, it's, you know, Palantir, whatever. And the pessimistic portfolio is this macroeconomic investing, which was, you know, betting against the U.S. economy, betting that the financial crisis was going to be big and was going to be worse than anyone, you know, expected, and kind of betting on an apocalypse. Anyway, he was right about that notion. I mean, there's this scene in the book that I think at the time the people who worked at Clarium thought was insane.
That was where.
Which was his hedge fund, where, you know, he and other senior people were talking about, you know, buying a bunch of gold and burying it, and you know, just like really just flipping out in a way that felt uncomfortable to some of the people who worked there, because, you know, because they didn't think, you know, banks were going to fail, but of course, you know, some banks, you know, did fail, and so it wasn't that like their crazy paranoia wasn't that far off. But then unfortunately, as I said, like the execution did not kind of match the insight. Thiel was not able to come up with like an investment strategy that to capitalize on this.
And
he kind of went the other way. Someone described it to me. It was like they were trying to find a contrarian take to their original contrarian take, where like you're sort of like, you think that this thing that you've called has now gone too mainstream, so you have to, you know, come up with something even weirder. And it was in that effort that they failed. They ended up trying to time the bottom of the stock market, and as a result, missed. They both bought when they should have sold, and then they missed the rebound. And as a result, his hedge fund completely failed. And you know, he had to basically. It was reformed as a, you know, family office, like the outside capital went away, and he lost billions of dollars. And after that, he then kind of restyled himself again, and not as a you know, cool hedge fund manager with a cool restaurant and a cool NASCAR magazine, but as the quirky tech guy. And that's when he starts backing seasteading. That's when he kind of goes back to the to his political roots. He starts writing more kind of out there, you know, libertarian political stuff. He's funding life extension research, and that's when the kind of like the Peter Thiel that most tech people would recognize starts to kind of come into focus.
Right. And for listeners, seasteading is this libertarian idea where you basically build a barge or some sort of island off the coast and you do what you want without the rules of the oppressive rest of society. Fascinating stuff. So maybe we should move Big Technology Podcast to some seastead so we don't have to pay taxes. Just kidding. But anyway, but he also has this founders fund where he does do this startup investing and starts the fellowship. You met him. He was telling you that there's been like three bubbles, right? The financial bubble, some other one, and then the education bubble, which is going to burst. And he basically said, like, if you end up spending too much money on a house, at least you have a house. If you spend too much money on education, you got nothing. And he started this thing that encouraged young people to take $100,000 a year from him. And the only condition is they drop out of college, right? So was that like the second half of his, what he was doing?
Absolutely.
Business influence, well, campaign.
And I think it totally was related to something else that was going on in the world at that time, which was the release of The Social Network. The Social Network, Thiel doesn't get very much screen time, but he is a sort of an important figure in that story, because it was Thiel who sort of set in motion this stock structure that creates the conflict between Eduardo Saverin and Mark Zuckerberg, which is the basis of the social network.
Yeah.
And as I understand it,
an early investor, one of the earliest investors in Facebook.
Yeah. As I understand it, he was part, one of the reasons that the Thiel Fellowship came into be was because he was trying to sort of take advantage of the moment and also shape the narrative, where at the time, the movie, right, the Social Network does not present a very flattering picture of Mark Zuckerberg. But Zuckerberg, I think very savvily, and Thiel did the same thing, chose to sort of flip it and say, actually, this just shows how cool we are. And their interviews with Thiel at the time saying, that these producers, these out of touch Hollywood producers, they didn't mean to, but really they're just making a great ad for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And it's right around this time that he, almost just as a media spectacle, announces, that he's going to give 20 young people under 20, $100,000 each, 20 under 20. It's totally like a contrived, kind of media thing, partly as in an effort to catch the sort of wave that's happening of interest from the social network, maybe to distract from the fact that this kind of Thiel is portrayed in the movie as kind of a schlubby, not that interesting suit. And then it takes on this life of its own. And of course, it's not just a media event. Real people come and real companies are started and it becomes this whole thing. But I don't think it was thought all that well through, beyond the top line. Here's the media. Here's how we're going to describe it to the press.
Yeah. And I think you put it well in the book that when he started to convince these young people to drop out of college, all of a sudden, I think that was a huge profile raiser for him. I mean, he goes from being a guy who, and of course he had done this writing, but he goes from being a guy who had managed a hedge fund and had a VC firm to someone who was like trying these radical new ideas to reshape society. And then people started, they called it the Thiel Fellows. I mean, it was good marketing for it, for sure.
And totally. And it was totally designed to for lack of a better word, like troll the libs, right? Like Slate did a hit piece on the, I'm using the sort of the builder language here.
Which they end up, using in the promotion.
They used it in their marketing. They loved it. It's like exactly what Peter Thiel wanted was to be called out by, some lefty journalist. And so I think it was totally designed to catch people's attention and it did. And I think, this is like one of the big surprises in reporting the book, is just that, not that it doesn't end up going well for all the Thiel Fellows. Like, obviously some of them have gone on to great success, but others, definitely, I think left the fellowship feeling a little bit used by it and feeling like, this worked out great for Peter Thiel. I'm not sure what I got out of it exactly.
Well, maybe they just weren't tough enough. No, I'm kidding. So I want to take a moment here, pause, and talk about the man that we just brought up, Mark Zuckerberg, because Thiel and Zuckerberg have an interesting relationship. In fact, when I was reporting Always Day One, I was told that, you know, Mark has a feedback culture and he likes to listen to contrarian voices. Peter Thiel is a contrarian. That's why he's on the board for this long. I wonder how much Peter Thiel's libertarian burn down institutions mentality has influenced Facebook's direction. I'm thinking about it in particular because the Wall Street Journal this week released these five stories that showed essentially Facebook, you know, blowing up institutions and failing to, you know, and kind of enforce its own rules. I mean, there's stories about how it's, well, making girls feel bad on Instagram, but I think more along the lines of where this came up, letting anti-vaccine sentiment run wild,
right.
Where the government really would like that not to be the case, allowing cartels and human traffickers to use the system and recruit and publicize what they're doing, and essentially giving a wide range, 5.8 million people, of VIP users, right? I mean, how could you have 6 million VIP users? I don't get that. But basically exempting them from content moderation and letting them say whatever they want to say. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking about your book and I'm like, damn, these are pretty along the lines of what Peter Thiel might want in a society. Essentially, yeah. Just like in a libertarian world, and just let it run wild and you stay out of the way and society sorts itself out. So I am curious what you think about that. How much influence has he had on Zuckerberg? And, you know, we point a lot to the problems that Facebook has today, but, you know, are they actually kind of like the idea?
Yeah. There's a line in Cecilia Kang, Cheryl Frankel book of, I think it's a quote from Kara Swisher about, it basically is like something to the effect that, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is like a blank slate that Thiel has. It's like a very extreme statement that I think probably overstates the case. Like Zuckerberg is a very smart person. He's obviously independently minded, but I do think I do think there's some truth to that sentiment and the sentiment that you're bringing up, which is I think that Thiel has had just an enormous impact on Mark Zuckerberg. Both in terms of like how the company is structured, like the literal way that Zuckerberg, got control of Facebook and maintained control of Facebook. And then, but also, this ideological thing, this notion that, as you say, institutions are really not that important. And that it seems like Zuckerberg sort of thinks that Facebook is like the only institution that really matters or something like that. But you know, for me in those journal stories, like one detail that really stuck out is, that they're getting these reports about, body image, women, young girls, like going on Instagram and are feeling really bad about themselves and really concerning research. And Zuckerberg's getting those and then getting asked by Congress, you know, hey, is this making people feel bad? And he's just, you know, totally.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's like having just a complete lack of respect for the institution. It's really outrageous because it's both a lack of respect for the issue and for Facebook's responsibility to society, but also just, you know, maybe people can agree to disagree. And maybe there are people going to argue Facebook doesn't have a responsibility to stop that. But just the treatment of, you know, whatever, our nation's highest, legislative body as just kind of a big joke is just kind of crazy. And I think it's completely in line with Thiel's ethos. And I think Facebook is in so many ways, another one of these attempts to kind of go beyond the traditional institutions. I mean, there've been lots of stories written about, you know, Facebook kind of seeing itself as its own country. They've got their own Supreme Court now and they're trying to have their own.
Oh man, Max, when I visited the first time, the conference rooms were all named after countries that Facebook was bigger than. Yeah. You walk in, you're like walking past the Brazil conference room. I'm like, oh, why Brazil? They're like, we're bigger.
It's just, yeah. I mean, it is really, kind of, I mean, like, as you say, it's in your face. And,
I do wonder, like, when we have Facebook promises, we'll do better. But maybe, I mean, I don't know. I know that they're separate from Peter Thiel. But I also know the influence. I'm also just like, maybe they're kind of close to where they want to be. And they can tell everybody they're, you know, everybody else can cry him a river.
And I also think, you know, there's kind of this, a lot of people have spent time trying to figure out, like, what is Mark Zuckerberg actually, like, what are his, does he have politics? Is he a liberal? Is he a conservative? You know,
yeah, I think he's gave some money.
Yeah, he's, I think, I agree. I think he's a libertarian. And I think, which I think, you know, 100% influenced by Thiel there. But I also think, to some extent, he has no left-right politics. His politics are whatever is going to be required to allow Facebook to grow as big as possible. You know, damn the authorities, damn the rules. And I think that, you know, even more so than Thiel's kind of like right-wing political views, I think that is more, that is the, that's the kind of core of the influence. And so, which, and in a lot of ways, like, that's a scarier influence because it's harder to talk about or even think about.
Right. And it must be wild in those board meetings to have Thiel, Zuckerberg, Mark Andreessen all together. Wow.
Well, I do think it's telling too, you know, the two longest serving board. So Facebook, you know, as you know, I mean, you know, they just kind of purged all their board members a couple years ago. And the board members who have survived, of course, are the two libertarians, Mark Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel. And I think that's, you know, that's no accident. It's, there's certainly some ideological alignment there.
Yeah. Let's end this segment talking a little bit about Elon Musk. So I'd love for you to describe the interesting kind of yo-yo relationship between Thiel and Musk, friends, enemies. And, you know, I'm just curious, you got Elon to speak to you for the book. That's not easy to do, especially when it comes to Thiel. How did you sell that?
I just asked him. Elon was not hesitant to share his views. He and I have a long history of, you know, whatever, we've talked many times, but, I think frenemy is the way that I kind of, you know, put it in my mind. I think,
yeah, because Thiel did put a pretty big investment in SpaceX. So
100%. And it's, I think that Elon and, Peter are basically just almost complete opposites, like temperamentally. You know, Musk is this kind of very emotional, all in, you know, if he's going to bet on something, he's going all in. He, you know, wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very, you know, he's very prone to, like, you know, getting pissed and then forgiving and then getting pissed again. And of course he's a gift to the journalistic gods because of that. Right. But, and Thiel, of course, is introverted. He's cautious. He's constantly hedging his bets. He doesn't ever want to go all in on anything. And, you know, he keeps it all, you know, kind of close to the vest. And so I think there's some temperamental thing, but as you said, you know, Elon was running PayPal, Peter led a coup that replaced him, and then they were able to patch it up. And I think basically, you know,
while Elon was on his honeymoon, he got replaced.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, pretty cold.
Oof. Yeah.
Yeah, it's also a testament to, like, I mean, it's easy to see, oh, this coup happened, but at the time, you know, Elon was a much more better respected, more famous entrepreneur than Peter Thiel. Elon had already sold a company. He had Mike Moritz, who is the, you know, most respected venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, behind him. So, like,
I'm just laughing because there's the story of Musk and Thiel where he bought, so he sold the company and bought this, like, what, $1 million. McLaren.
Yeah.
And then
McLaren F1. I think.
And yeah, he crashes it and was like, I didn't buy insurance because I didn't think I was the type of guy that would crash the car. That's an amazing story. Well, Thiel was in the car at the time.
Yeah. Was and he? Of course, you know, Thiel probably had insurance already on
Elon's car.
Yeah. but anyway, yeah. And I think that Musk, you know, basically forgave him. And Musk kind of said this in not so many words, but he basically concluded, like, look, it's not in my interest to make an enemy of this guy. And he was right. I mean, PayPal succeeded and they were able to kind of, you know, work closely enough together that when Elon really needed money, when SpaceX in 2008, SpaceX was failing. It had it had three launch failures. I can't remember if it was three or two. I think it was three launch failures. And you know, Elon is basically, you know, maxed out his bank account trying to fund Tesla. He has no more money. Thiel comes in basically as a white knight and saves the company. And I think does it kind of against his better judgment. I think does it with some anguish because it was, you know, obviously like if Elon had failed, that it would look very bad for Founders Fund. And as I understand it, you know, there was a lot of back and forth within Founders Fund over that investment where Luke Nosek was pushing really hard to do that investment. Thiel wasn't so sure because Thiel doesn't, you know, it's not his, you know, like taking that kind of risk is really not in his makeup, although he did it and the rest is history. And as a result, he's got a nice sized chunk of this very, very valuable, you know, rocket company. So it all worked out, but they definitely have, they're definitely like not, not best friends. They're more like allies or something like that.
Yeah. And he did make that investment, like, or the investment was announced a couple of days after Elon blew up a rocket. So, but yeah, it's working out well for him. What's your relationship like with Peter Thiel? I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the book was you talked about how you had this off the record conversation with him and he just kind of finished a sentence and left and you didn't know whether someone was going to take you out or of the room or something. And it turns out that was just the end of the interview and he never.
Yeah.
I think you said, oh, he was just kind of done talking. So, elaborate on this.
And, yeah. You know, I mean,
what
I can't.
What happened in that room?
I can't share any of the details of what was discussed. I approached this book as, you know, basically wanted to write a journalistic, portrait of the man. And in other words, to not to approach him as some kind of supervillain, which is, you know, has been the treatment sometimes. But also not to approach him with de facto deference, to just treat him. There's a lot of the coverage of Thiel, you know, this is kind of a crass way of putting it, but it's like, we're talking about a fellow Davos guy, you know, he's all right. There's this kind of like coziness of some of the articles that have been written about him that I think he's kind of encouraged where they're not really calling any of the failures out or really paying attention to anything in a kind of critical way. So I wanted to be in the middle. And so I was talking to, you know, former employees, basically everyone I could talk to, but also of course trying to speak with him and to get his perspective because that, you know, I thought that was really important. And we had this meeting and, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, what you would expect from somebody who's worth billions of dollars and is socially awkward. I mean, he just excused himself, but without actually
excusing himself.
But he was also, you know, very polite. I mean, you know, there was no, you know, a lot of people have asked, did they threaten you or something like that, you know, because of the Gawker.
No, he did bring down a publication.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but go ahead.
And I think that's totally worth talking about in terms of, to the extent that there was intimidation, the intimidation just came from the fact that he had done this thing. But in terms of the actual in-person interaction and interactions with his like PR people and stuff, they were not. There wasn't a hint of menace.
Right. He didn't send Charles Harder at you after you sent him the questions for the fact check.
They did not send Charles Harder after me. Charles Harder is not a big part of the book, though. So
yeah. Well, he's the guy, wasn't he? The guy who, the lawyer who he funded, so he could take on Gawker.
Yeah, Harder was the lawyer prosecuted the Gawker case, and I think,
with Thiel's money.
Yeah, with Thiel's money and in secret, and basically architected the destruction of this of this media platform that was really big and really influential, and also did, you know, of course, wrote a lot of like really tawdry stuff. Including, you know, the post that got Thiel mad, which, you know, said that he was gay. But Gawker also did a lot of important journalism as well. And so I think that case definitely created an environment where it was harder for journalists to really, think critically or write critically or talk to sources about Peter Thiel. It hangs over every conversation you have, every conversation with an editor, every conversation you have with a source.
Yeah, as intended. What's your relationship? I asked that. This was the question I wanted to ask you. Do you like him?
I'm trying not to. I don't really want to. I don't know. It's kind of like feels important to me to not like pass judgment or anything like that.
Yeah, but you must have some. I mean, I know. You try not to pass judgment, but you must have some personal feeling about here's this 330-page book about the guy.
Yeah, you're right. You're right to press me. Okay. I feel like he's worthy of respect, and I think there are aspects of his achievements and the things that he's done that are worthy of admiration. And I find, you know, I find him to be like a really interesting and charismatic figure, but I also think that he's pretty dangerous. And I think that the ideology that he has espoused and that he has pushed in all sorts of ways is bad, and it needs to be scrutinized and understood, and to the extent that it's filtering into these companies that are incredibly, incredibly powerful, that have, you know, unbelievable control over our lives, access to our data. I think we need to talk about that. And I also think, you know, especially as he gets into funding these political campaigns, putting $10 million into this guy, Blake Masters, running for Senate in Arizona, $10 million into J.D. Vance. Both of them, either former or current, you know, Thiel employees, I think those ideological questions become, you know, even more important. I mean, for me, the thing that is most troubling and that I think is worth a lot of conversation is just the relationship to democracy, this idea that democracy, you talked about indifference to institutions, which I think is definitely worth scrutiny.
If you're about to get, I think that you're about to get into some of the Trump stuff.
Okay.
I really want to do that, and it's a great place to pause here, go to break, and then pick up the Trump story. So why don't we do that? We'll be back here on the Big Technology Podcast right after this with Max Chafkin. He's the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. While we go to commercial, you can go to your favorite bookstore and pick it up. And we're back here on the Big Technology Podcast with Max Chafkin, features editor at Bloomberg Businessweek and also the author of The Contrarian, which is the book we've been talking about. It's all about Peter Thiel. A little biography of sorts, but, you know, getting a little bit more into the philosophical stuff. And I definitely want to talk about sort of the big Peter Thiel story where he gets to take his ideology to the world, the one that you said was bad ahead of the break. I think this is where you were going with it.
Yeah.
Where it extends to his support of Donald Trump. And then I would say more importantly, the way that he actually influenced the staffing of his administration. So is that where you were going earlier, Max?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so as you said, Thiel, you know, famously or infamously, depending on your politics, you know, made a big donation to the Trump campaign just before the 2016 election, and also gave this speech at the Republican National Convention endorsing Trump, and that gets him on the transition committee, and as a result, you know, gives him access to the Trump administration, and he is given an opportunity by Steve Bannon, who was his, you know, his ally, you know, his main ally in the administration, at least until Bannon was
ousted.
Given the job of appointing basically people who can, you know, disrupt, as Bannon put it to me, kind of disrupt the administrative state, who can help, you know, do the execute the Trump revolution on government. And so he has a chance to appoint all of these.
To pause. He talked about, you talk about it in the book, how the view was Republicans can win elections, Democrats can win elections. As long as the Democrats who believe in bigger government can staff these government agencies, the Democrats are essentially never out of power. And what they wanted to do is strip the agencies, or, you know, I guess they call it the swamp, or I don't know, of their power and of their people, so that they wouldn't have this Democrat influence. It's kind of questionable as to whether that's actually true about their thesis. But it is interesting because when Trump came into power, it was kind of weird to see him put people in charge of every agency to do kind of exactly the opposite of what the agency was tasked to do. And it was one of the most weirdest puzzling thing where, like, the EPA guy wanted to demolish, you know, all environmental protection, and financial people wanted to demolish the financial protections, and, you know, the list goes on. And now, actually, after reading this, turns out that this is sort of the influence of Thiel on the transition committee, getting these people in line, even if he was like moderately successful. Definitely the philosophy is
well, and that was applied. The thing that the mind blowing thing for me is that
you know, Thiel actually wanted to go a lot further. I mean, Bannon was basically like, told me basically, you know, Thiel's further out than Trump. I mean, Thiel was too far out. If you thought we were doing crazy things, like, you should have seen the stuff that Peter actually wanted to do. And, you know, that's, you know, Thiel attempted to get Balaji Srinivasan made FDA commissioner. Balaji Srinivasan, you know, a very opinionated, very outspoken, very hostile to the press.
Yeah, he wanted to make the medical approval process for medicines a big crowdsourced spreadsheet where people rate their experiences with the drug, and it's like, well, you could sort of learn from there.
Yeah, sorry, that was the idea. Replace insane. The FDA with Yelp, which of course, which actually I think is something that Thiel actually wants, or some version of that. They're in favor of, you know, drastic deregulation of drugs. And make no secret about that, but it's just kind of the idea of having somebody with like no government experience who wants to get rid of the FDA, run the FDA, and who's also just been totally intemperate on Twitter is just kind of crazy, and it wasn't going to work. Thiel also had the opportunity to suggest all these chief candidates for chief scientist, the top scientific advisor to the president, and his two main choices were climate change deniers. Who you know, one of whom, William Happer, you know, he's a very respected physicist at Princeton, but who has a sideline in arguing that CO2 gets a bad rap and it's actually good because it's tree food. And I mean, it's very like pretty fringe stuff. Yeah. And Thiel wanted him to, you know, have a major scientific position. His other candidate was this guy, David Gelertner, who is a Yale computer scientist. But who also kind of as a sideline is a big time provocateur, has written another, you know, kind of, you know, far right, you know, a book about, you know, how universities are too left. He's basically, you know, a provocateur. And so another guy who really had little chance to succeed. And so Thiel didn't do that well in terms of actually getting people into government. Although I think I would argue that he did have some influence on the Trump administration, and he kind of made the most of his time there, even if he wasn't able to get any of these kind of far out picks into government, because he was able to get, you know, access, you know, he set up this meeting, this big meeting with all the tech CEOs, gets Alex Karp, CEO of Palantir, in a room with Donald Trump, which I think was very important for Palantir, and has helped is one of the reasons Palantir has been so successful over the past 4 years.
Yeah, one of the interesting things to me was you wrote about how they in the transition team anticipated that Thiel was just kind of there for the photo op, but he never asked to meet Trump, and was all about filling the government with people who had his ideological beliefs.
There is this kind of like. Talking to DC people about Thiel, you know, they kind of often talk about him as this kind of cipher because he doesn't behave in the normal ways. And I think some of this may have to do with kind of inexperience. Like, and I think part of if he had been a more experienced political operator, he probably could have maybe he could have gotten Balaji, you know, made FDA chairman or something. But I think also some of it is that he's not playing the same game that many of the others are playing. And I don't think his game was the, like, let me, you know, have as much influence over the Trump administration as possible. It was, let me set things up so that my companies have as good a chance as possible. And that long-term he has political influence, which is exactly what happened. And, you know, post Trump, post, you know, January 6th insurrection, you know, Thiel, I think, has, you know, in a strange way, maybe more influence than he had, you know, even during the Trump administration.
Why is that?
Because he's been able to put himself in the middle of this, you know, the post-Trump movement. I mean, these candidates that he's funding, I mentioned Masters and Vance, you know, they are like kind of among the sort of standard bearers for you know, what I think it probably should be described as like Trumpism or, you know, nationalist populism or whatever. It's Trumpism with or without Trump. And I think that, Josh Hawley is another one of these figures, also a figure, former Stanford Review guy who has taken money from Thiel, who has endorsed JD Vance. There's kind of a little
to
crew.
See if Trumpism without Trump is actually going to work. It I think there's a chance that it was unique to the individual. Like Josh Hawley is just too polished. I think that you talked about like how it was like, you know, Trump was the inheritor of the Paul brothers, Ron Paul and his son Rand, and like what they realized, or you know, someone in their elk realized, was it wasn't necessarily the ideology; it was just they wanted the craziest person in the room.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's
it's really tough to be the inheritor of that philosophy, even though if you say the same things on policy, it's the fact that the dude could go and trash Rosie O'Donnell at a debate that was part of his appeal. Sorry, go ahead.
But no. But I do think that is Peter Thiel is attempting to be the inheritor of that movement, and to be the patron of that movement, to be the person who's behind the scenes for the 20 to 30% of the country that wants the guy who says the craziest shit in the room.
Right.
And which, by the way, that formulation is from this Reason magazine writer, Brian Butler, who wrote a really great book about Ron Paul. And this, there was this feeling among the libertarians. I think some libertarians feel, you know, a little bit betrayed by Thiel, because Thiel was, you know, Thiel kind of presented himself as a libertarian, but has kind of gone all in for Trumpism, which is obviously very different from libertarianism. But anyway, just to get back to the thing about, you know, what exactly is bad. I mean, I think the thing that's bad is, as they've been attempting, as Thiel and his acolytes have been attempting to kind of harness this energy, they're positioning themselves as sort of being okay with the January 6th insurrection. You know, Josh Hawley famously, you know, raised his fist in solidarity as he walked into the Capitol, you know, on January 6th. And we're seeing, you know, J.D. Vance and Masters to some extent, you know, kind of trying to thread the needle and be okay, or create a space where the people who stormed the Capitol are just protesters, and the police that tried to stop them are, you know, somehow, you know, strong arming, you know, civil disobedience or something like that. And that to me is very dangerous. And it's at least if you believe in democracy, it's dangerous, because it's totally hostile to kind of this core part of American government.
Right. And all throughout Thiel's life, he's talked about how, you know, quote that you see often in the book is voting's overrated. I don't really believe in voting.
Yeah. And he's said in all sorts of ways. There was this famous essay in the that was published by the Cato Institute, where he talked about, basically he decided that democracy was incompatible with libertarian beliefs, his beliefs. And he's, you know, been a patron to this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who is, you know, better known as Moldbug, but you know, this blogger who is, whose big idea basically is a dictatorship. I mean, he's advocating, you know, some version of fascism, and you're seeing this kind of spill into, you know, borderline mainstream Republican discourse, people talking about an American Caesar. And I think that is, I think you can draw a line from that idea to Thiel. And I think that is, I mean, that is a very, very radical position.
Yeah. One question I have for you. So Thiel, who we've spoken about, is gay. I, you know, obviously, like, he's, you know, the political beliefs cross the spectrum if you're gay. But I, one of the things I'm struggling to see is how he was able to align himself with people who were so militantly anti-gay. I'm curious what you think. I mean, here's one example that you write about in the book. Let's see, about Ron Paul. Paul's supporter preferred the old Ron Paul. The Ron Paul who talked like the one of Thiel's old Stanford Review columnists, who published a newsletter talking about Paul that said 95% of black men in Washington, D.C. were criminals, and said, "I miss the closet about gay rights." Like Thiel, they wanted to stick it to the cathedral. He was ready to help them.
Yeah. And if you go back to Thiel's, you know, to the newspaper, Stanford Review, or the book he wrote, Diversity Myth, you will find some views on you know, sexuality that are really, you know, pretty backwards. And there, you know, there's obviously a temptation to psychologize this, and you know, some people have suggested to me,
that, you know, it's self-hatred or something like that. You know, Thiel's a Christian, and, you know, maybe there's some of this is like a symptom of his own, you know, discomfort with himself. I tend to think he is a provocateur. And I think that it's always been profitable, especially in right-wing circles, to be in an out-group and to kind of crap on the other members of your out-group. Like that's kind of, there's like a tried and true path in conservative activist politics of doing exactly that. And I think, so I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's as simple as that. And I also think probably he just doesn't feel there, you know, he's talked about this a little bit. Like I think the speech that he gave at the Republican National Convention, which of course he was criticized a lot by, you know, gay rights groups because the Republican Party had positions on trans rights and gay rights that were really, you know, I mean, they were against those things. And I think Thiel, as he kind of said in that speech, like he doesn't want to be defined by his sexuality, and he doesn't want, he feels so strongly about that to such an extent that, you know, he's willing to, you know, ally himself with somebody who is, you know, part of a party that's anti-gay. I also think it's probably like, I think Thiel has talked about this, but Trump probably was like less hostile on gay rights than
many
other.
Yeah, I don't see Trump as hostile on
gay rights. Yeah, yeah. So I think there is some way to see it as.
Trump is like, I mean, Trump, sorry, I'm probably getting in trouble saying this, but, you know, Trump obviously said what he said about in Charlottesville, and I'm not absolving him of that. But also, like, guy grew up as a New Yorker. Ted Cruz
in real
accused
estate,
him of having New York values.
Yeah.
His daughter converted to Orthodox Judaism. So, you know, do I think he's backwards on race in a lot of ways? Yeah. But I don't know. I guess like his positions are a little more complicated.
Yeah. And I think there was like from Trump, like to the extent that Trump was like anti-gay, it always seemed a little bit half-hearted or something. and I do think there's a way to see, you know, Thiel's speech as an important moment, you know.
First time, right?
Someone
who was openly gay spoke at the Republican National Convention.
First time they acknowledged it on stage, because there actually had been one other. There had been another instance, but that person was booed during the during the speech. And Thiel not only wasn't booed, but he got a standing ovation. And like it was, when you watch it, you know, I do think it does feel like a moment. It feels like, wow, the beating heart of the Republican Party, they're not just accepting this, they are cheering for it, they're excited about it. So I do think that's something that probably, like on a historical basis, that will be an important historical thing that Thiel was a part of.
So wrapping up this chapter about politics and government, he did get some, why did he back Trump, right? That's a question that a lot of people ask. I think that like there's an idea that Trump and Bannon did embody a lot of the values that he wanted, but there was also the business rationale, which was that he had $3.5 billion sitting in an IRA that he didn't want taxed, Roth IRA. And he wanted his businesses, Palantir in particular, to be able to get government contracts, and thought that getting close to power would be a good idea. And he essentially made this $1 billion bet right after the Access Hollywood tape came out. That was like, all right, maybe Trump will be able to help me solve these problems. Let's see what happens. So how did that work out for him?
Yeah, well, I think it's important with Thiel to see that the business and politics are always connected. He has a sort of political project and a business project, and they work together in tandem. And you can't. His ideology is in service of his business. His business is in service of his ideology. They're hard to separate. Kind of like I think the Koch brothers. There's some of that with the Kochs too, where they're really good at combining. At finding an ideology that like sort of works with their business imperatives, and then finding business imperatives that work with their ideology. But I think with Thiel, it's two things. It's one, he was buying low. He had an opportunity to have a huge stake in this new administration that had very few kind of there was very little institutional support for Trump. It's not only that there was little institutional support, there were no like respectable business people who were backing Trump. It was all kind of, I mean, there were a few, but it was like largely, you know, if you go to who else was speaking at the Republican National Convention, it's like real estate, kind of shady seeming real estate guys.
Pillow sales people.
Yeah, some reality TV stars, like the guy who runs the cage fighting company was there, you know, Chachi from Happy Days.
Yeah. Hulk Hogan spoke there also, right?
I don't know if he actually – did he appear on stage? I can't remember.
Oh, he showed up, right.
Yeah, he was – I mean, he's, you know, one of the biggest celebrities in Tampa, so so that would make sense. But I also think that and there was so much effort among tech people, and I'm sure in private especially, to kind of like explain away Thiel's support of Trump as just being kind of a Machiavellian bet. He couldn't possibly really want Trumpism. And I think the truth is he does like Trump. I think there's a lot about Trump's ideology that is very closely aligned with Thiel's, despite the differences that I brought up earlier. The core of Trump's appeal is being able to get away with saying the racist thing or the sexist thing.
Well, I think you even note that like one of the things he enjoyed the most when in the watch party for the election was how angry people in Silicon Valley were going to be about Trump's election. Okay, but what about the money though? The deals for his companies. Did he make out okay from those?
Yeah. I mean, he did great. And I think some of it, it's always hard to it's always hard to untangle.
Yeah.
Okay, like why did Palantir get those contracts? Did Palantir Palantir got an $800 million army contract, another $400 million contract? It took over this Project Maven from Google. That's another $40 million a year. You know, it goes on and on. And of course, it's very hard to untangle. You know, why does a company get these deals? Because of course their explanation is, well, we were getting the deals because we have the best product and we've spent a long time selling it. But of course, when you're talking about defense contracts, I think inevitably like politics plays a role. And I think it's no accident that Palantir took off during the Trump administration, that really had a series of breakthroughs, you know, under an administration where Thiel had influence. I also think, you know, you brought up his tax status, and this we could probably have a really long conversation about this, but Thiel has been pursuing his whole career this very, very, very aggressive strategy to pay. It's legal, but just exceedingly aggressive strategy to pay almost nothing in taxes on his on most of his income. It's his investment income, because it's all in a Roth IRA retirement account. And there's been this feeling in Thiel's world that at any moment somebody could come along and take that away from him, either because there is a reinterpretation of the rules or someone changes the rules, which is something that was threatened during the Obama administration, but didn't actually happen. Or somebody finds, you know, if he accidentally got something wrong on his taxes, then it could all go away. And I think a lot of Thiel's sort of operations over the past decade or so can be explained by that. I mean, the acquisition of citizenship in New Zealand, which we haven't touched on, but you know, he secretly acquired citizenship in.
You know, Max, you are right. This is such a fascinating story because each one of these could be their own show. But sorry, go ahead.
Anyway, I think that it was widely interpreted, and I think this even led to some jokes in Silicon Valley that this is just him being, you know, apocalyptic. He wants a doomsday bunker, but I think the truth is he actually wanted a doomsday tax shelter, you know, just in case Obama goes to, because he saw Obama as a communist, you know, in case Obama, you know, goes full commie or something and tries to come for his money, Thiel is going to have a backup plan. And that backup plan is, at the time, a conservative government that was running New Zealand at the time, and it would be a way to create some leverage in a negotiation with the IRS, or, you know, worst case scenario, right? There have been these billionaires or sent to millionaires or whatever who have renounced their U.S. citizenship in order to get out of a tax bill. So that would be another option. And I think similarly, you know, Thiel's engagement in politics and his support of Trump, some of it has to do with, you know, wanting to make sure that the tax policy favors him. And, you know, this sounds, if from a certain point of view, this sounds outrageous, but of course, a lot of this is happening out in the open. I mean, we're seeing, you know, Keith Raboy and a bunch of these guys who have, you know, relocated to Miami, you know, they're doing it, you know, as they say, because they don't want to pay state capital gains tax in California. And you also hear that, you know, kind of another thread of Thielism, but this idea of exit, this idea that you should be allowed to, you know, withdraw from the government, either by going to a seastead, as you said, or by, you know, decamping for your New Zealand bunker. So I think a lot of the political motivation, some of the political motivation for Trump, came from that sense of vulnerability and a desire to like make sure that the tax policy stayed friendly to the interests of tech billionaires.
Right. So Thiel's out of office. No, it's not Thiel. Trump is out of office. Freudian slip. Thiel's got his money. What's his next act?
I mean, I think his next act, as I said, is continued influence in this right wing movement. Which it's true, you might be right that like maybe we will close the book on this and we'll get like kind of a more conventional Republican nominee, and then yeah. I think that'll really sideline Peter Thiel.
I personally think that it'll be the return of Trump or one of his kids.
Yeah, and well,
it would
then
be astonishing to me if none of them ran next cycle. It would be astonishing.
So I think his play is to have influence in that world and to continue to be a political kingmaker, mm-hmm. to play that kind of Koch brothers type role, but in the Koch brothers play that role in the kind of conventional mainstream Republican Party, but to play that role in the Trumpist party, whatever it's called, the Freedom Party or the Patriot Party, yeah. or whatever. And I think that's part of it. And I think also, continuing to make investments to do the investor thing. And, you know, he's been doing a bunch of stuff in crypto. It's sort of hard to figure out what he actually believes with crypto, because, you know, he's sort of like making investments, but then he's like crapping on Bitcoin. And, but so I think there's going to be, continued engagement in technology and also a real push in politically. I also think, you know, he has two kids now, and I do think it's possible that, you know, he's slowing down or something like that. Like we'll see. And I think, as you say, some of it may come down to, you know, what happens politically, whether it's an advantageous situation for him or not. But and this is a guy who really seems to get a kick out of being provocative. So it's hard for me seeing him not trying to find some new way to provoke. And when you have $10 billion or however much money he has, that could be pretty dramatic, depending on what he does.
Do you think he'll talk to you again after the book?
I don't know. I'm open to it.
Yeah.
Great. I hope so.
Well, the book was great, man. I didn't think I was going to get through it this week, and I couldn't stop reading it. So I think that...
thank you, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Difficult subject matter, like we spoke about. And it's well-rounded. It's good. It's engaging, well-written, packed with facts, and definitely enlightened me to a lot of stuff that I hadn't known previously about Silicon Valley and power and tech. And I suggest everybody go read it. Thank you, Max, for joining the show. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Alex. It was really fun.
Super fun. The book is The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. It's available in all bookstores. You can grab it today, sometime later this week. You know, help Max become a bestseller. All right. Well, that will do it for us here on the Big Technology Podcast. Thanks to Nate Guatney for editing this and mastering the audio. Thanks to Red Circle for hosting and selling the ads. And thanks, most importantly, to you all, the listeners. Show would be nothing without you. Appreciate you coming back week after week. And we will see you again next Wednesday.